Hello and welcome to Mohawks Meet the Team series, a podcast dedicated to the team behind creating the strategy title, Old World. We'll get to know more about the team and their work on the project. This week we get to speak to Alex Montzeris, a senior engineer for Mohawk, and we learn more about his childhood spent in Greece and much more, so stay tuned. Hello and welcome to the show, Alex.
It's great to be here.
And joining me for this week's episode is also Mr. Soren Johnson. Hello, Soren.
Hey, Rob. Good to be here. Looking forward to finding out more about Alex.
As am I. So we were curious to know a little bit more about you, Alex. I wanted to start off by asking you where you grew up.
Well, I grew up in Greece. I was born in London, England. So most of my family is still in Greece. I spend a lot of time in Boston, but now we're here in Maryland.
So your childhood was spent in Greece?
Yes, from like 2 years old to through high school.
Oh, very cool. So what part of Greece?
Outside of Athens.
Oh, that's, see, you said somewhere I actually knew. So there's not many places you could have said in Greece that I'm terribly familiar with, but I imagine Athens is a pretty large urban area then?
Yes, it's a pretty big city. I think it has 2 million people or something.
Why did you move into the United States after you finished high school?
Well, after I finished high school, I went to college in England. So I lived in England for 4 years. But then I came over to the United States for graduate school. And after school, I just thought it was so cool in the States, so I stayed.
And you originally moved to Boston?
Yes, that's where I went to school.
What did you get a degree in?
So my undergraduate is in electrical and electronic engineering. That was at Imperial College in London. Then for graduate school, I decided I didn't want to do an electrical engineering anymore, so I got a master's in naval architecture and marine engineering. So I thought I had enough education at that point, so I went back to Greece for a year and did my military service. But then I missed it, so I came back and got a PhD in hydrodynamics.
Okay, none of these sound like computer things, as far as like computer programming. So help me understand how you got from doing like nautical engineering to computer programming.
So I remember from, you know, your resume when we first interviewed you at Fraxis that you had all of this nautical engineering background, which kind of jumped out at me. And I haven't really necessarily ever followed up with that over the years. Like, were you big into sailing? Or like, I know, like, I don't know, this is like a big stereotype, but like, it seems like all of the shipping companies are run by Greeks. So there's kind of like a stereotype that Greeks have, like, you know, a lot of nautical, you know, they're very much into marine life.
Yeah, well, funny you should say that, because my dad was in shipping and stuff. But the reason why I did naval architecture is because when I was in Greece, I really, I was into sailing. We had a sailboat and we raced it all summer long and stuff like that. So I thought I wanted to design sailboats. So that's why I got that education. But then after I got the education, the work wasn't as exciting as programming. So like I switched over.
Right. And that was all the way through your PhD? Like the PhD was in...
My PhD was also in the same department. It's more specialized than designing. Right. Well, it was in computational fluid dynamics. So it involved a lot of programming. I didn't just switch to programming from scratch. I already had some experience.
Once you had that, you like were your first jobs in like programming for, you know, for the water? Or maybe, I didn't write the terms.
Yeah, so when you're in graduate school, you do research, and I was also contracted to work for, I don't know if you're familiar, but there's a sailboat race called the America's Cup, and that happens every few years. So I was part of three different campaigns in the 90s. So for the first one, you know, we made some models and came down to here to Maryland, actually, in a Navy tank, which was like 2,000 feet long, and told them and tried to predict their performance. But then for later campaigns, we did it all digitally. So we modeled the designs, and my research in fluid dynamics sort of solved the flow around those ships, those actually yachts, and did it that way. So we won the first campaign. We came runners up in the second. The third time, the boat almost sank. So I was like, I have to do something else with my life before somebody gets hurt.
The trajectory was not good. Okay. Yeah. Wow, but your boat won the first time?
Yes, that was the 1992 winner, yeah.
Okay. Wow. That's awesome. Whose boat are they? They're attached to different countries. Is that right?
Yeah. It was always for the United States team. Right. The first one was America Cubed.
Okay. So. I think I vaguely even remember that name. Okay. Wow. That's really cool. How big was the team then that like worked on designing the boats?
I believe we had one like yacht designer with his company, and then the team contracted out to like research institutions. And I mean, the team included the sailors and all the support and all the, but right. the design team was probably maybe, I don't know, 15 people.
Okay. And you were solving like a very specific problem about it, or is that?
Well, for different campaigns, I did different things. Yes, I was doing the fluid dynamics analysis of the designs for most of the time. Based on my doctoral research, I developed a method to do that like efficiently, and coupling the underwater flow with the wave flow and the aerodynamic forces on the sails. That's all fluid dynamics.
Okay, so you got very deep into that, and then you left it all behind, basically.
Yeah, well, the exciting because I got to
right.
create things, but then it was sort of going from America's Cup to America's Cup is sort of uncertain, and you don't know if the campaign will continue. And so right. I tried to find like a regular job, and the best regular job that I could find was in Texas, working for an oil company where they wanted to figure out, you know, their offshore platforms, what forces will act on their structures. So, and that was just basically pressing a button and analyzing the results. Not as exciting. So
okay. All right.
So you're not involved in that career field at all anymore?
I haven't done any of that. I don't even do sailing anymore. So
okay.
There's no reason to work in that field.
When's the last time you sailed?
Probably 15 years ago.
Okay. So it was still when you were in the U.S., you still sailed at one point.
Well, when I went back for vacation.
Oh, okay. To Greece. Right. Yeah. I've never been to Greece. Would love to go. But it definitely, I mean, just from a map of the country, so much, so much coastline, so many islands. It does look like an amazing place to sail around.
It is ideal because you don't have to sail for very long before you reach, you know, a destination worth staying there. And
yep. Are there islands small enough that they aren't inhabited? Like you just would kind of
yes,
look at them?
There are, but you wouldn't want to go there because it's all like rocks and like...
Sure.
It's not like the vision of the tropical right. island with a beach and stuff like that.
Yeah, the little oasis that the pirate gets marooned on. It's not like that, right? Yeah.
Right.
Okay. What was your favorite area to sail around in Greece?
I don't know. We went all up and down the Aegean. Yeah, I mean, it's not that different so that I can have a favorite right. part. But it's a nice combination of like a competition and a vacation.
Right.
So
yeah. I mean, how far would you sail far enough that you could like see Turkey? Is that like, would you go that far out, or were you just kind of like,
oh yeah. We actually went into the Turkish waters because, you know, with a sailboat, you can't really control where you go all the time. So,
yeah.
So we had to, and then a Turkish like naval, you know, warship showed up and chased us away.
Jeez. Wow. Nice.
I guess the farthest we've gone is Crete. And it wasn't even that, yeah. So these races would last maybe as much as 36 hours straight.
Oh, so these were actual races you're participating in?
Yes.
Right. Okay. What would you be your role when you were sailing like that? Like, how many people are on the boat? Like, what would you be doing?
About 8 people on the boat. Mm-hmm. It was kind of like my role in programming. I do a little bit of everything. So I don't have a specialty.
So growing up in Greece also, I have to kind of be curious since, you know, we're very much immersed in the ancient world. Like, did you spend a lot of time going to ruins, or was that not something that like you were particularly into?
That stuff is for tourists.
No. Oh, no.
No, I mean, you know how it is. Like, you
in
Washington, D.C., right? Everybody comes to Washington, D.C. to see all the monuments and stuff. Yep. And I hardly ever go. Yeah. Like, the kids go for school trips or whatever. Yeah. But we're not like, oh, let's go to Washington to see whatever, because it's right next door. It's kind of the same in Greece.
Yeah, no, it is pretty ridiculous. I mean, I've been out here for on and off for 20 years, and the only time I've been to the White House or the Capitol building was when I was a fifth grader, and I flew out here from the West Coast for a family vacation. You know, so <Yeah. laughs> it is pretty crazy. So, I mean, you've been to the Acropolis, yes?
Yes, I've been many times because I have friends who visit, and I have to go show them.
Oh, sure. Okay. All right. Right. Okay. You know, both Layla and I think, have talked often about we'd love to go to Greece and just spend a month going from all the different locations that we know about from history, and definitely is a place that we would enjoy as tourists.
So, yeah, it's a good place to be a tourist. Not so great to work there though.
Yeah, sure. What do you miss from Greece, though, besides the sailing?
Well, I miss my family. The family is the most important thing. It doesn't really matter where you are, especially now that everything's virtual and you can do anything. But the weather in Greece is pretty, I guess it's like Southern California or whatever.
Right.
So it's very reliable from like May to October. It's like hardly any clouds in the sky and you know, low humidity. And I mean, I don't know if I miss that, but it's the seasons are also interesting. And
it seems like we maybe skimmed over it a little bit. Like what, you were born in London, grew up in Greece, then went to school in London. At that point you were very European. Coming to America would have been a pretty big decision. Like, I know you said you came over here to go to school, but like, what was your thought process about coming to the U.S.?
I applied to all the good schools for naval architecture because that I wanted to do that. So a bunch of them were in the U.S. And when I got into MIT, it was kind of a no brainer to go there.
Sure, right. I mean, obviously, it's a very good school. I don't know how it ranks in terms of naval architecture, but I'm sure it does very well. I would think. I mean,
the thing with naval architecture is it used to be a very like common thing because there were more boats to make,
right.
and everything was by sea. But now they're not very many programs that do that. Even since I left, MIT has merged its naval architecture department with its mechanical engineering department.
Oh, okay. Yeah, I think even vaguely in back of my mind when I saw that was what you had gotten your degrees in, there was part of me that wondered, like, it seems like we've been sailing for a long time now. I don't know how much new territory there is to explore, but I know there's always something. Okay, so you really wanted to go to a very good program and got into MIT, which of course is like the best, maybe the best engineering school of the country. So
yeah, I didn't really plan ahead too much. I wasn't sure that I would want to stay here for my whole life before I moved here. I mean, as you can see, like I don't plan very far ahead. I just do something and then feel like doing something else or whatever, and it works out. It wasn't like I'm going into the unknown. My mother's American. She grew up in Chicago, so we went to visit her family every 2 years from Greece. So
okay. So how did she end up in Greece then? I met your dad, I guess, but like how did that,
Well, she was like after college, she worked for a year and saved some money and then took a year off and traveled around Europe.
Mm-hmm.
And then she never came back.
Wow. Okay. Wow, that's pretty amazing. Okay, so your mom grew up in America, she lives in Greece, and you grew up in Greece and you live in America.
Yeah, it's all messed up.
Okay. Huh. All right. Well, I didn't know you were sort basically half American. That's interesting. Okay, cool.
Tell me about the transition then. So you had this really awesome degree in hydrology and stuff, and you've kind of transitioned now from that career field to programming. What led to that decision?
I kind of touched on that earlier. I liked programming already when I was doing my research. Like that was actually the part that I liked. Solving the differential equations numerically wasn't as exciting as the programming part of it. So my education wasn't like I had a few programming classes, but nothing much. So it's been a long learning process, and I guess that's what keeps me motivated is the learning new stuff. I'm still learning. I still feel like I'm catching up with the programming part of my job.
It's interesting. I mean, there's certain key things I probably, because I had a traditional computer science degree, but there's some parts that are applicable, but I kind of feel like most of the stuff I do, I pretty much learned after my first couple C++ classes in school. You know, occasionally there's stuff that pops up. You remember like, oh yeah, I remember learning about this specific data structure algorithm, but it doesn't tend to come up too much. And the truth is like stuff has changed a lot since school, right? You know, a lot of what's valuable to know now is just, you know, the way C# works, which didn't exist when I was in school.
Yeah, for sure. It's that's another exciting part that it's new and changing all the time.
Yep. So you were in Texas working for an oil.
No, I actually didn't take that job.
Oh, okay. All right, I think maybe continue that story then.
Instead of taking that job, I took a job that sounded exciting at the time, which was a programming job. It was making a program that morphs itself into whatever application company wants, using itself to transform into something different. That was a company called Tenfold, and they made software for like financial companies and like insurance companies and stuff like that. So it was a database driven application, and depending on what it was in the database, it made the program do something different.
It sounds very abstract.
Yeah, it sounded cooler than it was.
Okay.
And then that company got acquired, and so I ended up writing software for a financial services company, and then Soren rescued me.
Okay. Sure. Yeah, let's talk about that a little bit. So presumably at the same time, you were into video games because, you know, I met you on a forum dedicated to Civilization. So, like, tell me about the games you played and how you ended up on Apollo. I assume it was Apollo, not Civfanatics, but
yeah. So I did. My brother introduced me to Civilization One, and I was hooked ever since. So by Civilization Three, I was active in the online community in the forums, mm-hmm. like Apollo.
Do you remember how you discovered there was not everyone gets sucked into the community? Like, what was it that appealed to you?
Yeah, it's sort of like I don't play very many games. Mm-hmm. In fact, I play one game for like 10 years and then I switch over. So when I do something, I do it like full
all the way, right?
Full. So like I wanted to learn more about it, and like somehow I don't remember exactly how I found the forums and stuff like that, but that was fun to find other people.
Right.
And like to explore the strategies and find the optimal strategies and like a little bit of modding and stuff like that. The game appealed to me because it had like a history, like underlying theme, and it had some definite like rules. It was a little bit like chess and stuff like that. So there weren't that many games back like that back in the early 90s.
Right. So what, you know, what I remember you as is, you know, you were this character named Alex Mann. Of course, I had no idea that meant that was just your name. And, you know, you had a little frog as your avatar. And you know, why was the frog your avatar?
That is because we were playing a game, you know, in the community. I think it was a play by email game. Right. And the only nation that was left over was France, and France was pink in Civ 3.
Yes, I remember that they were pink. Yes, good.
Yeah, it was just a joke. I mean,
okay. So you're France. I mean, of course, the French are often called the frogs. Yeah, okay, yeah. All right. So that's why the frog. And then what I remembered from a lot of your posts is I feel like it felt like you were often trying to reverse engineer some of the code of the game. Like it felt like you, at Civ 3, we didn't release the source code. So, you know, the community, you know, some of the algorithms in the game were pretty obvious, but some of them were a little more, you know, like harder to figure out. And I seem to remember you were always trying to kind of piece it apart, if my memory is correct.
Yeah, I mean, you need to know the rules if you're gonna, you know, find the optimal way to play. So I just did some experiments to find how things worked. I think the corruption system was the most. It was Civ 3 corruption system made it basically useless to have cities that were far away because they didn't produce anything. So people. Well, we're always trying to figure out, you know, how to beat that. So
I remember there was a weird thing with the corruption system where I was maybe a little lazy in the code I wrote, so that, you know, I kind of like ordered the cities, you know, like the cities closest to your capital had the least corruption and the ones that were farthest away had the most. But maybe I'm going to get this wrong, but I seem to remember that, like, if you had 5 or 6 cities that all were exactly 10 tiles from your capital, then they would all have essentially, they would all be tied for 10th. So they would have less corruption than if they were 10th, 11th, 12th, 13th, 14th, 15th, if that makes sense.
Yeah, I remember that.
Is that something you discovered, or was that like, I don't remember how that came about?
I think it sort of evolved. I wasn't the one who discovered that. But after I sort of released that empirical formula for corruption, people were playing with it and they discovered that, I think it was only, there was corruption because of distance and because of number of cities. And and the number of cities won. It didn't, I think, I don't remember the details, but yeah, there was no like tiebreaker. So
yeah, exactly. I just went for like the simplest thing. And naturally I've since learned that if there's a hole that people can figure out how to exploit, they will. And it's not necessarily that I care about it all that much. It's mostly, I just don't want people wasting their time on this type of thing, right? You kind of want to protect the player from themselves. You know, you want them just to be playing the game instead of like worrying about sort of this arcane formula hidden inside the game.
That's a very, very good thing, because I'm a player like that. I would spend all my time micromanaging if there's something to be gained.
Yep.
And it's not really enjoyable.
So did you end up recruiting Alex as a result of seeing him posting and trying to reverse engineer the game and seeing clearly that he had like an aptitude for this?
Yeah. I mean, I'd be interested to hear what Alex remembers of like our first interactions on Apolliton and like how, you know, how we first started talking back and forth.
Oh, maybe it was like you wanted people to be testers.
Yes.
And right. And you didn't say, hey, we need programmers, and posted that on the forums.
Right.
So I think I responded and saying, well, if you want a programmer, I can work for you. And then I came to visit you guys, and before I knew it, I was working on Civ 4.
Yeah.
I used to spend a lot of time on the game, Civ 3, and that was like when I first got married too. So understandably, my wife was not very excited about that. So she's like, "You got to stop doing this," she said gently.
What are you going to get
paid for it? So she didn't expect I would quit my real job and like make games for a living.
Yep. Oh, that's funny. Yeah, I actually have a very specific memory that it's one of these things where it's like so long ago I don't remember, but I feel like I remember that I sent you an email because I assume we brought you into the testing group, and that's where I would have got you to more. And I feel like because we had never really hired someone directly from the community at that point. And I would even say that inside of Firaxis, there was maybe even a little bit of like resistance to that, where like I tended to be kind of like the most pro community voice in the company. And I think just probably some of the people who were very used to there being a very thick wall between, you know, the company and the fans, you know, kind of like having maybe started developing in the pre-internet days, you know, they were not necessarily so sure about that. And I feel like I reached out to you to see if you were interested in a job potentially. And I feel like my first email never got a response. I felt like I was like, you know, I really think I should, like, Alex really seems like he'd be like a good person for this. Maybe you sent me an email like when we weren't ready to hire someone. Maybe that's how it worked. And then I sent you an email, you know, saying basically like, hey, we might be ready now. And you didn't reply back. And I thought it was odd. And so I think I emailed you again a couple of weeks later. And you then discovered that like my first email had gone to your spam filter. I remember that. Oh, I hope that's true.
Okay. Yeah. Well, I was trying to sort of get out of it, but yeah, I couldn't after you contacted me twice.
Oh, okay. Now I know. All right.
Yeah, it's too long ago. I don't remember the details.
Yeah.
I remember at some point I was sending you, like I looked you up and I sent you some email at your old Stanford email address or something like that.
Oh, wow. Okay. Check. Yeah. Well, that's possible. Yeah, that would be something I wouldn't have used regularly, like checked every month or so, right? So maybe that was part of it too. Yeah, communication was not quite so straightforward back then. But yeah, so we you know, I think Alex was kind of the first person from community we interviewed. I assume we flew you down to Baltimore or something, and you came to the office and met with various programmers.
Yeah, it wasn't really, it didn't feel like an interview. It was more like a tour of Firaxis. Yeah, that's when I met Mustafa, who was already mm-hmm. working at Firaxis. And I think, Tom Whitaker was there. And by the time I started working, Jason Winokur was also there. Like a lot of people who were part of Mohawk were at Firaxis at that time.
Yep.
Yeah, I'm super, super honored to be one of the first people to from the community to brought into the industry by Soren.
Yeah. I mean, now I think it's a much more, you know, it's not unusual at all, really. Like a lot of our recent hires are people from the community. So yeah, like I always thought, it always felt like to me hiring people who maybe have not even necessarily played your games, it just doesn't seem like the right place to start. It seems like you want to go the other way around, you know, look at people who are super into the games you're working on, and then look among that group, see if you can find some people who also have, you know, programming skills and, you know, are able to do that. And, you know, you're definitely a great example of that.
Yeah, that I think that's a good strategy. People always do a better job if they're interested in the product they're making. There are many, many talented programmers and artists, but if they're not interested or they don't play the game that they're making, their job is not as good.
Cool. So what do you remember about Sephora's development?
By the time I joined, that was like February of 2005. So mm-hmm. there were only like 6 months left.
Yep.
So I remember having to deal with redoing the UI from scratch 6 months before releasing it. Well, I didn't redo it from scratch. I didn't know enough to contribute very, very much for the base game. But so most of the stuff I remember is afterwards, all the expansions when there were not, you know, either alone or one of two or three programmers working on the expansions. And that was a lot of fun.
Yeah, that's right. You know, I was pretty burnt out by the time Civ 4 got done. So the expansions, you know, kind of were very much in the lap of guys like you. And, you know, I worked a little bit on Warlords, but if I remember, you know, Beyond the Sword was mostly, you know, stuff that you and a couple other people were doing at Firaxis.
Beyond the Sword was fun because I was like, in quotes, supposed to be like the lead designer for it.
Mm-hmm.
And you could play around with things like that. I never really designed anything in my life before. So after that was fun, but it made me decide that that's enough game design for me. I'm a programmer.
Why did you feel that way?
I don't know. I just find it frustrating when there's so many different solutions to a problem and you have to pick one. I like doing things that have one solution.
Sure. That's an interesting way to put it. Yeah, that's definitely one of the challenges with game design. And it's one of the hard things to argue about with, we'll say discuss with, you know, other designers and people giving feedback is oftentimes, you know, there might be a disagreement of way to go, but it's not like one person's wrong and one person is right. They might just have different priorities or different approaches, or maybe both approaches could be fine. You just have to kind of pick one and be consistent about it if you can.
Yeah, you can definitely make things work, and you can basically make anything work if you like spend enough time on it. I guess it depends. I mean, they might not be equally fun, but it's hard to figure that out beforehand.
Yeah. Yeah. Every once in a while I run into a design problem where we do it one way and then people like, they just kind of don't like it that specific way. And then you try it a different way for a while and then they don't like it that either. And then you go back to doing it the original way. And for whatever reason, sometimes just because all the other parts of the project have changed, suddenly now this old way, they like it that way. And it's, you know, it's like, you know, it's a weird process. I can understand that if you're coming from like an engineering perspective of like, you know, you want to come up with a perfect, you know, the perfect solution, that can be kind of frustrating. Okay, so what happened after Beyond the Sword? Because at that point, I was on my way out of Firaxis, so I wasn't too involved after that.
Yeah, after Beyond the Sword, then I worked on XCOM for a little bit. By that time, a lot of people had left Firaxis, and I followed Mustafa over to Scaleform. Well, mm-hmm. they made middleware for user interfaces. We used the Scaleform actually in Civ 4, so that's how the connection was made there. And Scaleform was bought by Autodesk, so I worked at Autodesk for a while. But we never like lost touch. Soren mm-hmm. and I always kept, you know, in touch. And Soren, you were telling me about the projects you were thinking about and stuff like that. And I almost joined Mohawk, you know, basically before there was a Mohawk. Right. We were talking about, you know, before Off-World Trading Company started, but the mm-hmm. timing wasn't good at that time. So, yep. so, but I feel like part of Mohawk even before there was a Mohawk.
Yep.
And so when I did join Mohawk just in time to start on old world from scratch.
Yep. Yeah, I definitely wanted you on board, and I was glad that we kind of got a second chance to do it. And I'd say that it was probably more important to get you on board for Old World because it's what, you know, it has such a strong Civ lineage, you know, that it was just very much, you know, the type of game that good to have you working on.
It's certainly been fun, and enough is different that it's exciting, but enough is the same that it's familiar and you can draw on your previous knowledge.
Yeah, like one thing it'd be interesting to hear about is, you know, coming over to one of the big changes in my development for Old World is traditionally I write the AI for games, the games that I work on, because I kind of very much view the AI as an extension of design. You know, like if you're not just trying to solve the problem for, you know, what's the best way to beat the player, you're trying to create a good experience for them. And for some that applies kind of differently for different types of the AI. Like that's especially important for like the diplomacy side of the game. You know, that's a very subjective AI to be writing. Whereas maybe the question of how you should move your workers around to build which, you know, put a mine there, put a temple there, et cetera, that's maybe a little more objective. But to cut to the chase, I had been kind of like telling everyone I was going to get to the AI in a couple months for about 2 years. It was something that the Old World was a really challenging project. And I'd say that the whole character side of the game and coming up with an event system and a narrative system, it ended up being a lot more work than I anticipated. And, you know, the truth was I was just never getting around to actually writing the AI. And so then Alex volunteered to take that over. And, you know, he's been doing a great job with it. And that'd be very interesting to hear, like, you know, your impressions and experiences, you know, like, you know, trying out, you know, writing the AI. I mean, I'm sure you obviously wrote AI for, you know, like Beyond the Sword and some other things, but like, it'd be interesting to hear your experiences with it, about your experiences with it.
First of all, I never wrote AI for anything really before. Beyond the Sword and all the Civ expansions, we actually contracted the AI out to somebody in the community who was a really good player and was actually changing the AI to make it better.
That's right.
During development, so we just incorporated his code.
Yeah,
it was a new, like, interesting, like, problem to solve, and that I've enjoyed it a lot because you have to know what you're doing, like. Like as a player, you have to sort of know the best way to play, but you can't just imitate human behavior. You have to do it in an efficient way, and you can't like have the player wait for a minute between turns while you're solving all the little details. So there's some judgment of what's important and what not. Never ending. It can never be perfect.
Right.
But yeah, it's been taking up, I would say, half of my time. So I can't imagine if you were doing that also, how that would work.
Yeah, I think the answer is when I did Civ 4, I wasn't married, I didn't have kids. I think that's basically how I pulled it off. And things are not like that now. Yeah, one of the hard things I've always found about AI is that it does come down to that thing of like, it's not obvious when something is wrong with AI, right? Like when we mess up something about pathfinding, I mean, I guess that's sort of AI. But so what I mean is like when we mess up something about how the game calculates science or how it does, you know, the city produces buildings and something goes wrong, it becomes obvious. Everyone sees it, right? But if something breaks about the AI, it's often like completely invisible to everybody, even the AI programmer, right? It just suddenly is like performing a little worse and you're not necessarily sure why. And like that's the thing that all, like, I feel like as an AI programmer, I'm always kind of paranoid about the AI just sort of like slowly devolving, right? Because I've forgotten how all the parts fit together.
Yeah, and when you're writing the AI and the game is not finished yet, the AI can break even, you know, if just because the game works in a different way now. So yeah, it's a challenge, but it's fun. I guess what I like most about it is coming up with a simple rule that governs the AI's behavior that sort of will apply to specific situations well enough for it to handle, because you can't like handle every little situation that arises. So it's kind of like an intuition to find big general rules for the AI to follow.
Right. Yeah. And we kind of set the bar high for ourselves, you know, in Civ 4 and Old World, because our AI is not hard coded. You know, it doesn't really pay any attention to like, this is a mine, this is a temple, this is a library. You know, it tries to handle everything at an abstract level. So, because it's supposed to work even if someone mods the game, right? And that, functionally speaking, I think like ultimately that leads to the best AI, but like functionally speaking, it makes the job a lot harder.
Yeah. Another couple of things that make AI harder for Old World compared to Civilization 4 is the order system, because you can't just start moving everything. You have to decide beforehand what's more important. And the stacking, you can't just pile all your units and attack from the same place.
Yeah, people have talked about that being an issue for Civ 5 and Civ 6 for quite a while. And I feel like we've actually done, you know, well, it's an interesting thing, because I think that when I saw the one unit per tile stuff in Civ 5 and Civ 6, like, I think it's a perfectly valid design decision. I just think the problem is that the maps are too crowded. There's just not enough room to maneuver, which makes things just even harder for the AI. And so that's why we kind of enforced an Old World, this really big spacing between the cities. So there is enough room that, generally speaking, you know, there aren't bottlenecks. And of course, the order system helps as well, because it lets you kind of, they can leapfrog past things if they need to. So that, to me, like, that's always like why I feel like in design and AI should be, you know, working hand in hand. If, you know, if it can't be, you know, by the same person, then it needs to be, you know, a sense of like, when you make a design, you should think about how it's going to affect the AI.
That makes sense.
All right. Well, I don't want to hog the rest of this, Rob. We should hear about non-work stuff as well.
Yeah, no, I just to kind of get to know you, who you are outside of Mohawk, because I know I understand you and Soren go back way back, but I'm just curious about the kind of hobbies you might have outside of programming. What do you do for fun?
Well, we already talked about sailing and stuff, but you know, when you have a family, it's not about your fun anymore. It's about what your kids think is fun. So it's all about them now. I drive my kids from pool to pool for swimming. You know, you take them places that they find exciting, and we have family time where we play board games. And but I don't think I ever take time to do a hobby on my own. I mean, if I find some time for myself, I just work out or something like that. Pretty boring person now. Boring dad.
I understand. I have three myself. How many kids do you have?
Three.
Oh, great. Yeah. I know your pain then. How old are they?
They're 9, 15, and 17.
Wow. Okay. So you're almost out of the thick of things with a couple of them at least, right?
I don't think you ever get out of the thick of things, but we'll find out.
Yeah, tell us someday. Yeah, right?
I was hoping there might be a light at the end of the tunnel, but I guess not.
Yeah. How has COVID been for high school? Like I've that's one thing I've kind of felt for our kids, is like, it's tough for them missing school, but I kind of feel like missing high school would be the worst.
My kids are fine with it. They enjoy being home.
All right.
I mean, I enjoy having them home. It's fun to pretend to be like a teacher and learn some of the stuff that I never knew from high school. Like, I don't know, some American history or like long division or whatever. Right. Yeah, obviously they miss their friends. But they communicate through, you know, online with them. Yeah. And sometimes when you communicate online, you have to think a little bit more of the purpose, or you have to make up things to talk about. And the friendship goes more deep than just saying hi in the hallway or whatever. So sure. They're doing fine. I enjoy. I mean, obviously, I feel super bad about the COVID and how people lose their jobs or even lose their loved ones and stuff like that. But for me, it's not bad because it hasn't hurt my productivity for work, and I get to see more of my family.
And you said you live in Maryland now, right?
Yes.
Yeah. So I'm just curious to know, like, what is life like in Maryland right now? I mean, I'm in Northern Virginia, so I kind of understand like what the Northern Virginia and DC metro area is like. But for the most part, are things starting to kind of come back to normal?
I'm not really the best person to ask because I go outside like once a week.
So. Nice for you.
I think I've driven my car 4 times since last March. One of the times was to go to the office to get my computer to bring it home. And and maybe, you know, like another time was to drive and get a flu shot. So we haven't been out very much. But from what I understand, it's getting a little better. Hopefully the vaccination will fix things quick.
Well, I guess you don't do the shopping, do you, Alex?
Amazon.
Amazon, okay.
Oh, nice.
You guys get your food from there too?
Yes, everything.
Everything, okay, yeah. We're starting to dabble with that a little bit right now with meal kits, but we're also within walking distance of the grocery stores, so we will still go there. But that's not the best part of this experience is going out and shopping with masks. That definitely is not great.
Yeah, so what are your primary responsibilities now? I know you're a programmer, but like, what kind of stuff do you focus on?
So I do a little bit of everything. Like I said before, half of my time approximately is doing the AI. I do some game code. I did the multiplayer. I'm working on map scripts. I've worked on miscellaneous systems, like, I don't know, really the undo, redo, the replay, cloud saves. I do a lot of mod support. I don't know. I often prototype like a new system, and then somebody else takes over and does it properly.
Nice. That's very cool. So how do you see, I mean, like, as we're kind of, I know that the end is in sight, it's not necessarily right around the corner, but, you know, how do you see your responsibilities shaping up towards the end as you guys wrap this project up?
We don't have too many things that big systems that we're going to add, but there's a lot of polish that we need to do in optimizing performance. So I'm not exactly sure what will come up from now until the official release. Yeah, I mean, I expect we're just working on making the game a better experience, and I'm sure we'll be working even after the release to continue to improve it.
Yeah, I mean, like, we're literally meeting about, like, the last big meeting we had, you know, about, you know, that involved Alex was literally like the end game wrap up screen, right? Like, we're kind of at that phase of the project. But there's always more to do. And as he, you know, as he definitely knows as an AI programmer, like, that, you know, he could probably spend as much time working on that as we would allow, right? So
very good stuff, Alex. So if we were to try to find you online, where can we find you on social media?
I don't do social media. That's for the young people.
You're not the first person who said that here at Mohawk. That's good. Okay, so you're someone who can only be found at the at your home, really, at this point, right?
Exactly.
All right, very good. Oh, Alex, it's been a great opportunity to get to know you better, and I was really excited to hear some of the backstory between you and Soren. I had no idea you guys had known each other that long, so thanks for taking the time out of your day to talk to us.
Thanks, Rob. It was fun. Bill Ferry.